This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
I really appreciate you tuning into Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Everybody's becoming an astronaut these days. Have you seen this? Three different private companies recently launched civilians into space, not professional astronauts, but ordinary Joes and Janes. On Monday, it was announced that Captain Kirk from the Starship Enterprise is going into space next Tuesday, October 12th. This is for real. William Shatner, the Star Trek actor, now 90 years old, will boldly go where no other television actor has gone before. He's going to become the oldest person ever in space after that record was just set not even 3 months ago by an 82-year-old woman. We'll talk about why there's such a fascination with space, and we'll draw some lessons from this remarkable renaissance in space travel. In our second segment, we'll further explore the effects of this deal between America, the UK, and Australia, AUKUS, particularly the reaction coming from the Vatican. This is one more major impetus for Europe to unite in a far more robust way than it has before. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote about this in his Trumpet brief on Monday. We're going to get more details on the pressure on Europe to pull together in the face of recent decisions by the United States. Arizona recently released the results of the Maricopa County forensic election audit, and the press universally said that this showed Joe Biden did win that county fairly in the 2020 presidential election. But that is flat out wrong. In fact, the audit revealed massive fraud in that election. We'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this. And to finish the program, we'll talk about one of history's first astronomers. And this man was around long before you probably think. Let's get into this fascinating phenomenon, the advancement of civilian space travel. This past summer, a couple of billionaires had an unusual competition. Entrepreneur and adventurer Richard Branson has been working for 17 years on a project that would make him the first civilian to make it into space, not a professional astronaut, through a private space company. He planned to ride his new space plane on its first voyage later this past summer, but then Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and of the space company Blue Origin, he announced that he would ride his rocket into space on July 20th. So Branson moved his flight up to July 11th to beat Bezos. Well, his plan worked. He successfully took an hour-long trip that reached 50 miles above Earth's surface. That's considered where space begins. This was the first time that a spaceflight company independently launched a civilian into space. And then on July 20th, Bezos also blasted into space, and he took his brother and two other people along with him, an 82-year-old woman and an 18-year-old student. They set records for the oldest and the youngest people ever in space. And this flight reached a peak altitude of 66.5 miles. And amazingly, it only took 10 minutes from launch till landing. They traveled 66.5 miles up and back down at an enormous speed, a really impressive flight. Now, these billionaires want to make space travel available for paying customers. Up until now, only about 560 people have ever made the trip to space, basically astronauts working for government agencies. But now that number is likely to increase a lot. Branson's company, Virgin Galactic, is charging something like $250,000 to $450,000 per seat. And it says that they already have over 600 commercial passengers signed up, and they plan to start commercial spaceflight service next year. Bezos says Blue Origin has nearly $100 million in sales of seats on future flights. And just a couple of weeks ago, another billionaire, Jared Isaacman, served as mission commander and benefactor for an all-civilian crew aboard Inspiration 4. This was a rocket built by SpaceX, a private company led by yet another billionaire, Elon Musk. And this was the first all-civilian mission to orbit the Earth. They didn't just poke at the edge of space and then return in less than an hour. They actually soared to 364 miles above Earth. This is a higher orbit than the International Space Station. And then they circled the Earth over and over again every 96 minutes for 3 days. I find this quite impressive. It's one thing to dream about going to space, but these people are actually turning these dreams into reality. They want to explore new frontiers. They want to push the bounds of exploration. And there's a spirit behind these projects that really points you back to the great explorers of antiquity, the people who sailed on ships across the Atlantic in search of new lands, the early Americans who settled the West. We live in a world that is plagued with problems that narrow our focus and our field of vision. You have places like Afghanistan, where freedom has rapidly been choked out, where oppression is taking over. You even have the same trend happening in formerly free nations like Australia, places like Canada, Britain, even here in the United States. We're getting claustrophobic with all of these lockdowns and mandates and so on. And at the same time, you have people reaching for the stars and achieving some pretty remarkable success. Isn't that a fascinating contrast? Really, there's a lot of evidence that we're living in the final days of man's rule on Earth. We're beginning to see a dramatic upheaval in the world order that is going to lead to nuclear World War III. And it will also lead to the beginning of a brand new world ruled by Jesus Christ. But there is a lot of hopelessness overtaking this world, even though it does lead to tremendous hope when you understand the context provided by Bible prophecy. But it's in this climate that these space projects are taking off. It's very interesting. Now, why are people so fascinated with space? What are they trying to accomplish? For one, there are people who say it's all a waste of money and resources. After Richard Branson reached space, Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted this: "Here on Earth, in the richest country on the planet, half our people live paycheck to paycheck. People are struggling to feed themselves, struggling to see a doctor. But hey, the richest guys in the world are off in outer space. Yes, it's time to tax the billionaires." That was Bernie Sanders' take on Richard Branson's voyage into space. The question has been asked of Elon Musk on a few occasions. Why put all this energy and money into these space projects? And Musk said, well, I agree. Basically, he said, 99% or more of our resources should go toward problems on Earth. But we should devote 1% or even a lot less than 1% of our resources to these kind of visionary projects and forging out into space. Doing things like this really does take vision, and it takes courage, and it takes tremendous determination, as well as a lot of work and innovation and creativity and engineering prowess and all of those things too. But what is it that specifically motivates these people who are undertaking these projects? Why are Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos sending civilians into space? Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' company, has a tagline that reads in part, "Earth in all its beauty is just our starting place." A New York Times article earlier this year said, "Mr. Bezos' most extravagant notion, unveiled in 2019, is a vision of space colonies, spinning cylinders floating out there with all kinds of environments." And this article quoted Bezos saying, "These are very large structures, miles on end, and they hold a million people or more each." And he noted that they're intended to, as the New York Times wrote, to relieve the stress on Earth and help make it more livable. Elon Musk has also a very ambitious plan. He said his company wants to land he said they will land humans on Mars by 2026, and he's raised billions of dollars to make this happen. Now, why put humans on Mars? This is from a Daily Mail article, September 28th, 2020. Elon Musk has a plan to ensure the long-term survival of humanity. We must become an interplanetary species in a spacefaring civilization, he says. Musk has had his heart set on colonizing Mars for many years. Musk had previously said in the past that SpaceX would need to produce 1,000 Starship rockets over a 9-year period in order to take 1 million people to Mars. And this Daily Mail article says both Musk and Bezos are looking at the long-term survival of the human race, although they have different ideas on how to ensure we survive. Musk sees migrating to different planets as top priority, while the Blue Origin owner envisions humanity moving into massive space stations. So it's interesting. This actually does tie into the fact that we're suffering all these problems on Earth. These men can see these problems, existential problems, like the development of weapons of mass destruction, coupled with political instability. That's taking over more and more nations in this earth, and the kinds of arms races that you see taking place in the world today. And these men also talk about climate change and the fact that we could actually make this planet unlivable. These are crises that actually jeopardize man's survival on this planet, at least as far as they can see. And so they believe we need to look elsewhere for a place we can call home, including massive structures floating out in the middle of the space like WALL-E, that cartoon from Pixar, or huge colonies of self-enclosed structures planted on the surface of the hostile Martian environment. This is how they want to ensure mankind's survival. How inspiring is that to you? What do you think of the idea of living in a giant ship and not having the opportunity to go outside or go for a hike? I mean, I suppose if Jeff Bezos builds a space station that's big enough to hold 1 million people, there would be plenty of things to do on there, like a big cruise ship or something. But what would it be like to not be able to take a drive to another state or country or visit another climate? There really is no place that supports life the way Earth does. Space is a wasteland. If you do put a colony on Mars, if you go outside that controlled environment, you are dead. You know, if you don't have the proper spacesuit, you can't breathe out there. You're not going to be going out there to take a swim in a lake or something like that. I would imagine life in a spaceship or some distant colony would get old very, very quickly. I mean, just think about how difficult it's been with COVID lockdowns, being holed up in our homes and not being able to travel as much and those types of things. There are a lot of people that are kind of going crazy with just how restrictive life has grown on Earth. I was pretty fascinated by the SpaceX mission, the Inspiration 4. They were four people that were in a capsule for 3 days orbiting Earth, and they had this lovely window that they could look out. The cupola at the top of the capsule just had an extraordinary view of Earth. But really, the idea of being in that capsule for more than about 3 days isn't very appealing. What do you do in there? You can float around, you can look at Earth through a window, but you can't go for a walk. You're kind of like a gerbil in a little cage. 3 days would be plenty. And then you come back to Earth and you say, wow, it's great to be home. Earlier this year, NASA landed the Perseverance rover on the surface of Mars. And that rover has been working there on that planet ever since. It's been sending pictures and video of what it's doing there. It's collecting rock and soil samples to bring back in a few years. It really is a phenomenal engineering achievement. Now, why are scientists going to all that trouble? Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote a cover story for The Trumpet in our May-June 2021 edition, and he said, why do scientists want to reach Mars? It gets back to one overall question, is there life there? But they're asking the wrong question, Mr. Fleury wrote. They should ask, why are Mars and the rest of the universe there? This question leads us to the Creator. Scientists are focused on the creation, not the Creator. And though it may be done in ignorance, it amounts to an exercise in futility and rebellion against God. Really, all these projects, these efforts to explore other planets and create space stations and colonies to ensure humanity's survival, these people aren't bringing God into their thinking. It's just human beings trying to solve human problems with human reasoning. Mr. Fleury continued in that article, some dream of somehow escaping Earth and introducing life to Mars. Can they do that? He says, look at what human beings have done to this planet. We're about to destroy all human life on Earth. And then he says, even if we escaped, we would bring rebellious, destructive human nature with us. Even if we found life on Mars, we would just destroy it in the end. These are really excellent points, inarguable points. When you think about the kinds of projects that these people are undertaking, NASA said it wants to send another mission to the moon. It actually asked for bids to build a lunar lander from Musk's company and Bezos's company. They want a private company to build this lander. And apparently Blue Origin said it would build the lander for $5.9 billion. SpaceX bid $2.9 billion. And NASA went with SpaceX. So Jeff Bezos decided to sue NASA. He said that the bidding process wasn't fair. And last Friday, NASA clapped back at Bezos. The Science Times quoted legal filings from NASA that said all of this once-in-a-generation momentum can easily be undone by one party, in this case Blue Origin, who seeks to prioritize its own fortunes over that of NASA, the United States, and every person alive today who dreams to see humans exploring worlds beyond our own. Science Times said, according to the space agency, what starts off as a simple procurement delay all too often evolves into a lack of political backing. They went on to say that a funding is siphoned out for these other projects and the mission is eventually canceled. So this project, NASA wants to put more people on the moon, could easily be kiboshed by a lawsuit from Jeff Bezos against NASA. These are the people that think they can save humanity by building space stations. It's pretty remarkable. Human nature is very virulent, it's very strong, and it isn't going to remain on Earth if human beings migrate to other planets. Now, the Bible actually reveals that God does have a purpose for all that space out there and all those planets out there. He actually does intend us to go out there eventually. And this really is a truly inspiring vision of space and the universe that does give us hope for the future survival of mankind. And it's not an idea out of some billionaire's imagination. It is a genuine plan that is already in motion, enacted by the Creator of the universe. We have a booklet called Our Awesome Universe Potential that explains this truth from the Bible. I'd encourage you to order a free copy of this booklet. We also have a book written by Herbert W. Armstrong called The Incredible Human Potential, and it goes into great scriptural detail in proving God's ultimate plans for the human race. This book is also free for the asking. Human beings are out looking for life on other planets, but the Bible reveals that right now, physical life exists on only one place in the universe, and that is where God specifically put it. You can read about that miraculous process in the first book of the Bible in Genesis, where God renewed the face of the earth by his word, where he said, let there be light, and then he planted this planet with life. Earth truly is exceptional and extraordinary and a miraculous contrast to everywhere else in the universe. And these space travelers have such big plans. Jeff Bezos is excited about going up 66 miles. You know, if Earth were the size of a basketball, that ship got away from the surface of that basketball about 1/20th of an inch. It wouldn't even make it to the 1/16th mark on a normal ruler with inches. The Inspiration 4 crew was hovering at about 364 miles away from Earth. That's not even half an inch away from the outside of that basketball. Meanwhile, the moon would be the size of a tennis ball, 23 feet away from that basketball. Mars would be the size of a shot put, over 2.5 miles away. You know that if our entire solar system out to Pluto were shrunk to the size of a quarter, the Milky Way galaxy would be as big as the western half of the United States. And the center point of the Milky Way is about 27,000 light years away from us. And for all 200 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy to make one revolution around that point takes about 250 million years. And the universe has some 2 to 3 trillion galaxies like ours. And what's amazing is when the SpaceX capsule landed, the ground crew told them, "Welcome back to planet Earth," as if they were intergalactic travelers. These people are taking little pokes out into space, and they're talking about how they think they can save humanity. They're so excited about these accomplishments and the idea that they're traveling out into space. But it really means nothing compared to the future that God is offering us. Learn about that future. Space is the final frontier, and it's actually waiting for you. And Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos aren't going to get you there, but the creator and sustainer of the vast universe will, if you turn to him and you let him lead you to fulfilling your incredible human potential.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The military arrangement recently reached between America, the UK, and Australia, AUKUS, caused quite an international stir. On last Friday's Week in Review, we spoke about Europe's reaction with Mihailo Zekic. We're going to look more specifically now about the reaction coming from the Vatican. To talk about this, we have via Skype from a field office in Canada, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So, as I mentioned, we spoke about this last Friday, but if you could, describe Europe's response from your point of view.
Yeah, it's. I mean, obviously, there's been the France throwing all the toys out of the pram. If anyone listened to Friday's show, I think you'd be familiar with that, where they were outraged. I think, though, beyond the outrage, one of the big reactions that's been developing from Europe has been this push for, well, we need our own military, we need our own army. I mean, obviously, we saw that in Europe after the pullout from Afghanistan. And then we've been seeing that kind of again after the AUKUS agreement. You saw, for example, the Telegraph had a story that Emmanuel Macron was willing to give up France's seat on the European Security Council to give that to the European Union, in exchange for European support for an EU army. Now, that story was afterwards denied, but it's still interesting that that came out that way. It's an interesting aspect to pay attention to. I think as the initial outrage and temper kind of bubbles down and people move on from that kind of anger, the push for a European kind of force so that they can be their own player in the world seems like one of the more long-term effects of this.
So how much support was there among other European nations for the kind of outraged response that you saw from France? Was that pretty common Europe-wide?
I mean, not with the same intensity as from France, but certainly there was a lot of sympathy for France or nations taking their side. You had Germany's ambassador to the UK talking about how the deal threatened the unity of the West. For example, you've had now columnists from, say, major Italian newspapers talking about Europe's need for a European military now because of this. So certainly shared across Europe, yes.
So let's focus now on the Vatican. How did the Vatican respond to the AUKUS announcement?
So the Vatican's Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, he talked about how the Vatican was worried about the deal. They kind of focused on the fact that these are submarines with nuclear technology, and he said that the Vatican is against rearmament and all the efforts that have been made and are being made. Basically, he said that it was making the world more dangerous, that it was bringing the world to even more conflict because. I don't know, the logic's a little hard to follow, but I guess these are nuclear. Nuclear technology is bad, according to the Vatican, and dangerous. And so even though this doesn't give Australia nuclear missiles or anything like that, by giving them nuclear-propelled submarines, it makes the world a more dangerous place. That was his statement.
So it almost seems like the knee-jerk reaction is we don't like what Australia is doing here, even though there isn't necessarily a real cogent reason, a logic behind that, but it seems like it fits with the Vatican's response to a lot of what America does. They just don't like the United States. They don't like policies coming out of America, and they have just kind of a knee-jerk reaction against that.
Yes, well, especially if you look at Pope Francis, that I think seems to be one of the, I mean, that seems like that's got to be probably one of the biggest themes of his presidency papacy. obviously we look very closely at the Catholic Church here at the Trumpet. You know, there are a lot of critical Bible prophecies about the Catholic Church, unifying Europe, about Europe becoming led by this religion, and Revelation chapter 17 talks about this religion leading the Catholic Church. And if you look at what Pope Francis has done in his time, I think the way that he has done the most, the thing that he's done the most in terms of moving a lot of that prophecy forwards, is this anti-American agenda. And a lot of it is cloaked in anti-capitalist rhetoric.
Right.
Where he's done a lot to condemn an economic system that you don't have to connect many dots to see he's condemning the economic system that America promotes. And then he really kind of pins this economic system as the cause of all wars, the cause of global warming, the cause of poverty. It is painting America in an incredibly negative light once you connect all of that. And then I think you see this then when it comes to this AUKUS alliance, which doesn't really have anything to do with that economy. you would have thought in some ways that the Catholic Church would welcome this. The Chinese government has done a whole lot to try and stamp out Christianity, including Catholicism, in China. So from one point of view, maybe they would have welcomed somebody standing up to that. Mm. But no, instead, it's another, well, we've got to hold this up as another aspect of being of something that's evil. I mean, you look at what China has done over the last several years. I mean, this is the, you know, we're seeing more and more evidence about how coronavirus leaked out of a lab, and there's so many questions about that. You know, what has China done to the world just in the last few years? There's a pretty compelling case that we need more people standing up to China. But to turn around and to make America kind of the evil one here and the one that's making the world more dangerous and bringing more conflict by standing up to China has things completely backwards. But there's an important reason for that. The Catholic Church is a critical force in uniting Europe. And I think you see them playing that role now in helping to try and turn Europe against America.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is a really excellent point. The Vatican's stance in light of the bigger picture and just how much, like Gerald Fleury has been talking, China is steering the world toward war in many ways. And the fact that that China would take China's side over America and Australia certainly poses no threat to world peace the way that China does, really is quite extraordinary. Now, I'd like to talk about this fascinating article in Crux Now from John Allen Jr. Gerald Fleury actually quoted from this man in his trumpet brief on Monday. And this man wrote that, I guess it was after the AUKUS was initially announced, he said Europe's future is up for grabs. He was just talking about how much uncertainty there is and this push for a united military and so on that you're describing. At this point, there's really no leadership to stand up and to turn that into reality. But this article, this more recent article, goes a little bit further than he did in that initial article. And he actually does talk about the Catholic Church and the role that the Catholic Church might play in shaping Europe's future. Maybe you could just talk about that.
Yes, I mean, he makes some of the same points that we've made, that the Catholic Church, or that Pope Francis has been particularly anti-American, but that the Catholic Church has always been not particularly keen on NATO, and they've wanted Europe to, you know, you've got this alliance of the West that has been kind of Europe, Britain, America, Canada, and then Australia, New Zealand, you know, Japan, maybe something like that. But the Catholic Church has long had this vision of Europe that's separate from that, that's not part of the West, that's its own way, a third way, as it's been called sometimes. So, you know, you've got you've got the potential now for this Pope to try and help make that happen. So you've got this point where Europe is talking more about, well, we need our own military, where, as one journalist said, we've got to be Europeans now because America just cut us loose. He writes in that if there is a unique moment now for Europe to get its act together, the foundation of any common political project almost certainly would have to lie in some form of Christian humanism. Or, you know, really, I think what he's talking about there is some form of Catholicism or religious unity that also includes Europe's Protestant churches, that brings some of them back into the fold. But that you've got to have this religious vision and underpinning for this European project, and that now could be an excellent time for the Catholic Church to step forwards and apply that. It says the takeaway is that for the next few months may be decisive in whether Europe can develop a political infrastructure capable of, of undergirdling von der Leyen's desire for enhanced military capacity. In that effect, the Catholic Church across Europe, and especially the Vatican, could play a decisive role. For decades, the Vatican has wanted a more independent, assertive Europe, one that can provide a genuine global counterweight to both the United States and Russia and China. Granted, the idea of a more robust military may not exactly be the Vatican's preferred method, he said, especially under a peace pope. I mean, that's his words, such as Francis. But the objective is nevertheless a long-standing Vatican idea fixe. So you could see this pope or the Catholic Church that has just condemned America for militarizing, supporting Europe and encouraging Europe to militarize itself.
Mm-hmm. And that very much is in line with Bible prophecy. That's exactly what we're expecting, as you mentioned, that there it this religious component to European political and military unification, in addition to economic unification, is so critical because it is so fractious, it is so disparate. The idea of actually getting 27 heads of state together there's actually been some criticism of this. The idea that the European Union should have a unified military is just absurd on its face, because you would need the buy-in from every single one of these 27 states. And this is just kind of the perpetual problem that Europe faces. How do we act without one person in charge? And military deployments is probably the most challenging of anything that Europe could do in those terms. It requires singularity of will to be able to do something like that. For the Catholic Church to be able to lend its weight behind that kind of unified vision really is necessary. That's something that Herbert W. Armstrong was talking about decades ago.
Absolutely. I mean, he talked about how this exact problem, that for Europe to come together, they need one leader. And he said, well, there's no way that they can accept that one leader without the Catholic Church being involved, having a role, promoting it, because that's the only way they can have some heritage that they can all kind of get behind and feel like they own that leader and are represented by him. So, yeah, it is it has been Europe's perennial problem, but the Catholic Church is their only solution.
Well, there is no doubt but that European integration is a massive, massive ask, that it's going to be pretty miraculous for that to take place, given all of the disparate views that you have among European leaders. But it's exactly these kinds of developments in the world, the United States decline in leadership, what happened in Afghanistan, what's happening with this AUKUS agreement that is pushing this discussion forward, and we'll just have to continue to watch to see how this unfolds. Just the fact that you have commentators like John Allen talking about the need for the Catholic Church to step up and provide some kind of ideological glue to hold Europe together and enable them to move forward is quite interesting. If you're aware of Bible prophecy, we've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about Europe's response, especially the Vatican's response to the AUKUS agreement between the U.S., the U.K., and Australia. I want to refer you to our editor-in-chief's trumpet brief from Monday. The title of that is After Afghanistan and AUKUS, Watch Europe. He really is focused on what's happening in Europe right now. It's something we all need to keep our eyes on. Thanks so much, Richard. Appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Did Arizona's recent election audit actually prove that Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential election fair and square? You'd think so from reading the media. We'll get the real answer in this report from Andrew Miller.
On September 24th, the Arizona State Senate finally released the results of the Maricopa County forensic election audit. Major media outlets were quick to report on the development. Newsmax reported, Arizona audit results revealed Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden by even bigger margins. The USA Today said, Arizona audit affirms Biden's win didn't prove voter fraud, contrary to Trump claim. The New York Post went with, President Biden won Arizona, no matter what Trumpland believes. And a New York Times headline read, Republican review of Arizona vote fails to show stolen election. The Wall Street Journal blasted, Trump loses Arizona again. Yet these major media outlets are guilty of deliberate deceit. They have reported that the audit established that there was no substantial difference between the hand count of ballots provided and the official canvass results for the county. But they have ignored evidence showing that Maricopa County was flooded with thousands of illicit ballots. In other words, The audit actually shows that Democrats stuffed Arizona ballot boxes with illicit ballots and then counted them accurately. Maricopa County provided Joe Biden a 45,000 vote advantage in Arizona, propelling him to a victory by over 10,000 votes statewide. Yet the Maricopa County forensic election audit has found many mail-in ballots did not have the legally required signed affidavit. In fact, a study done by the Massachusetts Institute for Technology found more than 17,000 duplicate images of return envelopes. When the study eliminated these duplicate ballots from their review, they concluded that Maricopa County had recorded more than 6,000 early voting return envelopes than actually existed. And in addition to these duplicate ballots, the Maricopa County Forensic Election Audit found 14,309 mail-in votes in Maricopa County were sent from voters who had moved out of Maricopa County prior to the election deadline. So if the state excluded these illicit ballots from the official count, then Donald Trump would be the decided winner. The major media will not admit that fraud has been exposed, yet supporters of Donald Trump are peppering Arizona's governor with demands to decertify the election, and elected officials in several other states are pushing for Arizona-style audits. At the conclusion of Mike Lindell's cyber symposium, Virginia State Senator Amanda Chase announced the formation of an election integrity caucus to expose voter fraud across America, and the Arizona audit is going to give them a lot to work with. In his article, What Will Happen After Donald Trump Regains Power, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury explained that President Trump was the legitimate winner of the 2020 presidential election. He also explained that Bible prophecy says Trump will return to power, but the indication is that regaining office may take considerable work. Donald Trump will have to fight for it. It doesn't have to be military action, but it certainly could. President Trump could also lead some states to secede from the Union. This could lead to some type of warfare. This astonishing prediction is based on 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 28, which reads, "For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, that it was bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Lord said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam the son of Joash. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all he did and his might and how he warred and how he recovered Damascus and Hamath, which belonged to Judah for Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel?" Mr. Fleury explained that President Trump is an end-time type of King Jeroboam II. God used President Trump to temporarily save America from the radical Marxist forces seeking to destroy it, and now he is going to have to fight and war to recover the stolen office from him during the 2020 presidential election. It is taking weeks to complete, but the Maricopa County audit may indeed fell the first domino in a process that ends up exposing an entire stolen election.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. So Arizona has been held up as kind of a model in some ways. There are other counties, other states that are looking. They've been watching what is happening and what the results are for this Arizona election audit as a signal for what they might do in their own jurisdictions. How much is what has happened in Arizona being copied and emulated elsewhere?
Right. Well, earlier this year, I think that was up to like over 20 something states actually sent representatives to Maricopa County while the audit was ongoing, just to look at it, ask questions, see how it was done. And there were a lot of people really, really impressed with how thorough it was. It did like a full forensic audit of a lot of like the electronic systems, or as much as they could get. I mean, the Dominion machines, they never did turn over those passwords, so that was a little more superficial there. But they did examine the electronic voting machines. They did a hand recount of the ballot. They did some signature verification. So looking at all sorts of different areas of voter fraud. And several of those states are not all 20, but several of those states do want to look into doing something similar at home. There's actually Fulton County, Georgia, has already completed kind of a Maricopa County style audit, and found similar things that I was talking about in the earlier part of the program, and that the hand recount matched pretty close. But with you start looking at signature verification, and there was a number of ballots that looked they were illegally cast. So both Maricopa County and Fulton County have already demonstrated that there was enough illicit ballots, or at least highly suspicious ballots, to tip the election from Biden to Donald Trump. The canvassing results say that Trump and Biden that Biden won the election, but after the recount, after the audit, it showed that Trump was the real winner in both those counties. And so if state legislatures or the federal government were to actually act on the finding of those two audits, Trump would have been the winner of both Georgia and Arizona. And now there's actually already Texas and Wisconsin are in the early stages of doing their own style audits. Now, Texas, President Trump won anyway, but they just to be sure there was no minor fraud, try to nip that in the bud. Texas is doing an Arizona style audit, and Wisconsin is in the early stages of that as well. Plus, both Michigan and Pennsylvania haven't begun the audit, but there are legislators, Republican legislators, that are pushing for it. A lot of them actually think that Pennsylvania could be really pivotal if that audit happens, because right now it's like, even if Trump were to have won Arizona and Georgia, that's still not enough to like change the national election results. But then you start throwing Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania, since Pennsylvania is worth 20 electoral college votes. I'd have to do the math again, but I think Pennsylvania, Arizona and Georgia, those three would probably be enough to actually show that we picked the wrong president nationwide in the last election. And since, like I said, Arizona and Georgia have already demonstrated that there was enough fraudulent ballots for like either signature verification doesn't match, you moved out of state before you cast your ballot, things like that, to tip the election, that you'd really just need one more big state like Pennsylvania, or maybe two more smaller states like Michigan and Wisconsin, to prove that the entire election was stolen.
The fact that there was this much fraud in the 2020 presidential election, and that it was significant enough that it would have changed the result of that election, this is something that a lot of people push back on, that there's a lot of resistance on the part of the media and big tech and among politicians, that the message is just so strong and so steady that this is of the past. We've got to move on. I think, given all of the evidence that is out there, it astounds me that you don't have more people who are saying, okay, whatever you think of the 2020 election, even if you just say, okay, well, let's just say Joe Biden took that election, you still have to, every single county in the entire nation has to be concerned about every election going forward. I'm amazed that there isn't more determination on the part of officials on both sides of the aisle. Anyone who is concerned about the integrity of our constitutional republic and the integrity of the elections that we hold, saying we have to make sure that we close every door, that we every loophole, every possibility of fraud, and every one of these instances where fraud has been proven, to make sure that that doesn't happen again. Otherwise, it really is just a matter of who is able to rig the system well enough to ensure that their candidates get into office.
Right. I think it is no exaggeration to say that unless this issue is examined and like stringent laws and electoral reform put into place, that you'd never have another free election in the United States. And that's really what a lot of the Democrats are pushing for with their For the People Act, that's trying to do away with photo ID requirements and other things like that, that would basically legalize the type of fraud used in this election. Because that's one of the interesting things coming out of Maricopa County, is it really does show like an ideological divide between the nation, is that so far there hasn't been much evidence that the reported numbers of the ballots were rigged, that the count was rigged. It was more that the ballots that were there were cast by illegal immigrants or someone who lived out of state, or they're fraudulent ballots. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that will change when you start looking at some of the Dominion voting algorithms in the future. But like right now, I think that is one thing that why the Democrats at least don't care much, is they're already pushing for that, like, well, we want felons to be able to vote, and we want 16-year-olds to be able to vote, and we want illegal immigrants to be able to vote, and we don't want people to have to provide voter IDs. And so when they see that, like, oh, well, the hand recount matches, they're like, all right, well, if the ballots are the ballots, then Biden won. Mm-hmm. I think Democrats, even Democrats, maybe more sane Democrats who are concerned about election rigging, are mostly concerned with, like, well, was the count rigged, not did that ballot there come from someone who actually has a legal right to vote in this nation.
If you can't trust the election results, the whole thing is a charade. And people think, well, this can't happen in the United States. If you look at the world and elections that take place all over the world, it's far, far more common to have a fraudulent election than it is to have a fair election. And, you know, elections are really just theater in most nations, where they're just aimed at legitimizing leaders who hold on to power by whatever means they can find to do so. And to think that that is essentially what there are a lot of people that want that to be what happens in the United States is truly shocking and distressing. And you would think that there would just be a lot more virulent pushback on the part of anyone who had any kind of hope for preserving the integrity of our constitutional republic. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the Arizona election audit, how deceitful the mainstream media reporting on this was. He wrote an article about this, Arizona Audit Exposes Massive Fraud. You can find this on thetrumpet.com. This is really a story we need to keep watching because of, as he mentioned in his report, the prophecies of Donald Trump actually returning to power. So we will keep watching that. We thank you very much for bringing this to our attention, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
When you think of Abraham's time, do you think of dusty tents, whistling wind, and bleeding sheep, uneducated men, hard scrabble living? If so, you might be surprised at the real history. Abraham's world wasn't primitive and ignorant. In fact, it possessed advanced astronomical knowledge that would take thousands of years to rediscover. Abraham lived in Ur of the Chaldees, a city in Babylon, at the heart of the civilized world. Archaeological evidence reveals that the Babylonians had detected the precision of the equinoxes. This is quoting from a book by John William Draper, History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. They knew the cause of the eclipses and could predict them. They had correct views of the structure of the solar system and knew the order of emplacement between the planets. Other history books corroborate that when the Greeks conquered Babylon, they discovered advanced astronomical observations and even a map representing the world as round with Babylon near the center. Babylonian priests knew where the sun, moon, and planets were positioned. They recognized their orbits. They calculated where they would appear at any given time in the future. Pretty impressive. Now, how did these people know? Berossus, a Babylonian historian, wrote this: in the 10th generation after the flood, there was among the Chaldeans a man righteous and great and skillful in the celestial science. That man was Abraham. Not only was Abraham a giant of faith and obedience, he was also a wealthy and influential world leader and an intelligent, well-educated scientist, mathematician, and astronomer. The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus confirms that this great Chaldean was Abraham and that the Greek Hecateus wrote an entire book about his accomplishments. Other secular historians add that Abraham was a scholar renowned throughout Ur. Josephus says he analyzed, quote, phenomena that were visible both at land and sea, as well as those that happen to the sun and moon and all the heavenly bodies. The Babylonians got their advanced understanding of the heavens from Abraham. Abraham taught them the nature of the sun, the moon, eclipses, the planets and their orbits inside our solar system, and the stars that lie beyond. Far-flung heavenly lights that they and other pagan believers thought they were just an assortment of gods. Abraham showed that these gods had no minds or power of their own. He said that he could predict exactly what they would do and where they would be ad infinitum because they had to obey specific laws. Later, when Abraham left Ur, he traveled in Austria and Egypt, and he spread the knowledge of arithmetic, astronomy, and culture even beyond Babylon. How could a man who was standing on the surface of the earth without advanced scientific instruments understand that he was on a round planet orbiting the sun alongside other planets? How could he recognize a star versus a planet in the morning sky? Where did he learn the mathematical laws of how to predict eclipses and other astral events? How could he know these heavenly bodies were not actually gods? Well, he had been taught by the true God, the one who authored the laws of astronomy and physics that govern the heavens. Abraham wasn't actually the first astronomer. Josephus says the study of astronomy originated in the family line of Seth. He wrote that God gave those who lived before the flood such long life that they might perfect those things which they had invented in astronomy. Job also had advanced astronomical knowledge, such as the understanding that was unknown except by divine revelation for many centuries to come, that earth hangs upon nothing, that it's just floating in space. But you can read that in Job 26 and verse 7. Ancient histories indicate that Noah had knowledge of maritime laws involving navigating by the stars. That ancient and elderly patriarch likely brought knowledge of mathematics, astronomy, agriculture and other sciences, as well as the arts, from one side of the flood to the other. And that passed down from generation to generation to Abraham. What is most certain is that Abraham's scientific knowledge came through his connection with the Creator God, the one source powerful enough to create stars and galaxies and suns and moons and planets, brilliant enough to set them all in order according to perfect laws, and loving enough to teach those laws. The world traces its astronomical knowledge to Babylon. Babylon traces it back to Abraham, the servant of God. So why did God teach a tiny human living on a tiny planet the undiscoverable systems and laws of the cosmos? Why did God teach Abraham astronomy? Well, there are several reasons. The Bible's descriptions of God's creation says that he set up the lights of the sun, moon, and stars for signs and for seasons and for days and years. True knowledge of astronomical laws preserved the measure of the week, the months, and the years by which to measure time, as well as the day of the week that God set apart for worship, the Sabbath. In addition, without that knowledge, today we wouldn't have any idea of the ages of the ancients who dwelled on earth before Moses. We wouldn't know the duration of events like the flood. Yet Moses records detailed ages and histories in the Pentateuch. On top of that, God clearly used the revelation to inspire and motivate his servants. When he promised Abraham that he would become a great patriarch, he compared his descendants to the stars. And he also revealed to Abraham the holy city to come, which will serve as the headquarters of the universe. You can read about that in Revelation 21. And that was a vision that fueled Abraham his whole life. God designed and created the universe for his purposes. We should hardly be surprised that, as Amos 3 and verse 7 says, he revealed its secrets to his servants. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Richard Palmer and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Harry Emerson Fosdick. No steam or gas ever drives anything until it is confined. No Niagara is ever turned into light and power until it is tunneled. No life ever grows until it is focused, dedicated, disciplined. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.